Welcome to Home to Her, the podcast that's dedicated to reclaiming the lost and stolen wisdom of the sacred feminine. I'm your host, Liz Kelly, and on each episode, we explore her stories and myths, her spiritual principles, and most importantly, what this wisdom has to offer us right now. Thanks for being here. Let's get started. Hey, everybody, this is Liz. Welcome to the show. I'm joining you from Central Virginia, as usual, the unceded lands of the Monacan Nation. So glad that you're here with me. And hey, if you have listened to the show, you know what's coming next. If you would like to know whose native lands you are currently residing on, go to native-land.ca. Amazing map, super helpful of North America for sure, but they cover pretty much the entire globe. So it's a great way to find out whose lands you're residing on. I will put that in the show notes. And if you are interested in learning about the sacred feminine in a deeper way, then I would love for you to check out my online school, Home to Her Academy. My vision for the school is to bring together qualified, super engaging instructors who can teach us about the sacred feminine in ways that are rooted in the historical record. There's so much there to work with. We should know it. It's our birthright. But also ways that are embodied and intuitive. So inviting us to know with more than our minds. I see this very much as a both and situation. We don't have to choose between knowing with our minds and knowing with our bodies. We can do both. Learning in ways that are intersectional, so really addressing head-on these messy entanglements of spirituality, patriarchy, misogyny, racism, colonialism, all the isms, and practical, learning that's practical, so meaning we can apply this to our real, ordinary, complicated lives. So check out hometoheracademy.com to see what's going on and what's coming up. You can sign up for my newsletter there so you can be notified of other classes as they roll out. I'm getting super excited about planning for 2024. So keep checking back, even if you don't see stuff right away. I'm working hard behind the scenes. And if you'd rather read about the sacred feminine, then maybe you want to check out my book, Home to Her, Walking the Transformative Path of the Sacred Feminine from Womancraft Publishing. It is a 2023 Nautilus Gold Award recipient. Wahoo! I'm laughing at myself because I just always feel super self-promotional, and yet I can't stop doing it because I'm happy about it. It's available wherever you buy your books, but if you're going to buy it, please do consider buying it from Womancraft, which is an amazing woman-owned business, or order it from your local bookstore. And if you've read it and you like it, your reviews on Amazon and Goodreads in particular are super helpful, as are reviews for this podcast. I'll take them anywhere. iTunes is really helpful in that regard, though. And then last but not least, tell me what you think. I love it when you all reach out to me and give me your thoughts on episodes or ideas for shows. So reaching out to me via social is always a good way. And I'll put all of that in the show notes. And that's it. That's my spiel. Let's get on with the show. So if you have been listening to the show, actually, if you just listen to my intro, it's not going to be surprising to you that I get really geeky about having conversations about the sacred feminine that can explore the rich historical record. I'm sort of a dork when it comes to this, but also this more like embodied ways of knowing. I love it when we combine these two things. I don't want to have to choose between them. It's very much a both and situation for me. And I get really excited when I know that my guests have that same perspective. This is one of many reasons why I've been looking forward to this conversation today. I have felt really honored to get to know my guest over the last few months. Her work is endlessly inspirational to me, and this is going to be a good one. So let me go ahead and introduce her to you. Here we go, Carla. I'm going to get your last name right. I'm going to do it. Dr. Carla Ionescu. Yes. Okay. Yes. Is a Romanian refugee who escaped the communist regime with her family when she was 10 years old. She is also an adrenaline junkie, an animal lover, and a natural born storyteller. She likes to ride motorcycles real fast and research through archival documents very carefully. You love her already, don't you? Carla's research centers on the influential nature of Artemis across Anatolia, the Mediterranean, and the Balkans. As one of the leading experts in the worship and ritual of the goddess Artemis, Dr. Ionescu spends most of her time teaching in the field of ancient history and women's studies and or applying for grants to support her research travels. In the summer, she scavenges new locations and cities worldwide, digging through the remains of grave sites, ruins, and abandoned buildings, trying to uncover the long-lost mystery that is Artemis the Great Mother. And she's also the author of the book, She Who Haunts, Artemis, the Goddess Who Changed the World. And she is joining us today from her home in Toronto, Canada. Carla, yay, you're here. I'm so glad.
I'm here. So glad to be here. Thank you so much, Liz, for having me. It's been a pleasure getting to know you too and talking about all the things that we have come to connect with.
Yeah.
With the goddess and her story. Yeah.
Yes. For listeners, Carla's one of those people that, you know, and when you start to do this work, you like, there's just people that are in your field and people who come into your field, but you haven't met them yet. And you're like, oh yeah, I'm really down with what they're doing, you know? So I was very excited when we finally got introduced, I don't know, maybe 6 months ago or so. And yeah, it's just, you find a sister on the path and you want to stay close to them. So yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
Well, Carla, so where I usually like to begin interviews is I love to hear about people's spiritual background and experiences growing up. And the reason I ask that is so oftentimes there's a pivot point for, you know, people who are exploring the sacred feminine, or I'm fascinated if you did get any of the sacred feminine growing up, but I just like to hear what that experience was like for you and maybe what you kept and, if anything, and what you had to discard. So if that's all right, I'd love to start there.
Yeah, no, that works. As you mentioned, I grew up in communist Romania, and there was a weird push-pull there with religion. I remember celebrating things like Easter with ritual. So there was a ritual, in short, a ritual about walking around the altar with a candle, walking home with the candle still lit, and then sort of putting it out in your front door. I don't know. There's probably a few Greek Orthodox who are my age who remember this ritual. So there was a few moments of ritual allowed, but church wasn't something that was really allowed. Like, it was a weird, I was a kid, you know, so for me, it's a bit of a daze. And so it was all Greek Orthodox, Romanian Orthodox when I was young. And it was a bit mysterious because Romanian Orthodox, the priest faces the opposite way. They still did their masses in Latin. So there was like this mystery. We still drank wine when we did have a few of these rituals from a glass that, now that I think of it, we all shared, the entire congregation share that glass. And we had like real bread, you know, little pieces of hard bread. So I do have some memories of childhood attendance at some things in church. My father was not really a church person, but my mother was very much a church person. And then we escaped, we ran, we got away, we came to Canada. And my parents, in order to put me in Catholic school, my mother's Italian, so she was raised Catholic. And so, I don't know, they signed some papers, they did some stuff, and I went to Catholic school. And then from there, my Catholic upbringing became quite consistent, you know? And so the one person, character that I connected to, you won't be surprised, is the Virgin Mary. And I became devoted to her in such a powerful way. I used to have a little icon of her holding a baby Jesus that I got at a dollar store when we first got to Canada. We lived for a bit. We lived in like a homeless shelter for families for a couple of years. And my parents used to shop at this little dollar store, and they used to have these little figurines of Mary, you know, these little like things. Anyway, I used to sleep with it under my pillow and like how to say my prayers. And I was super, super, super attached to her. And so that went on until I went to university. Even though I can't say I was like a religious church Sunday goer every Sunday, but I was very committed to Mary in my personal life, my prayer life. And then I went to university and I got a bunch of degrees, blah, blah, blah. But one of the degrees that I got was in religious studies. And I thought, you know what, better than to connect with the divine? And so I started studying at university. I started studying the Gospels and the Hebrew Bible and all these kinds of things. And how do I say this gently? It broke my faith. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Learning the history was devastating. Yeah, it was devastating. It pulled the veil from my eyes. It's like my education at university was such a privilege in many ways, but such a break with my reality. And so for several years while I was finishing that degree, because I dug even more into it, I didn't know what my faith was. I had to reconcile a lot about sort of the facts that we know about how the Christian Bible is written, a bunch of, you know, historical data. And so I was a bit in a abyss of heartbreak, in a sense, still attached to the Virgin Mary, even if perhaps her virginity was called into question academically, and trying to figure out, well, for sure, church is not my thing, you know, learning about the patriarchy in this really devastating way. And so I went on to do my other degree in ancient history. I've always liked mythology, blah, blah, blah. And I stumbled upon Gimbutas' work.
And that's Maria Gimbutas, right?
Yeah.
For listeners, yeah, who might not know her, can you just say, I know she's come up on the show, but in case you're brand new here, can you just say a little bit about who she is?
Yeah, so Maria Gimbutas was an archaeologist in the 70s, a famous, incredibly talented, multilingual, academically superior, in my opinion, archaeologist that did so much work on goddess figurines and goddess worship, particularly in Eastern Europe, which is where I come from, but all over Europe too. She inspired many of those movements. And then she was, I don't want to say demoted, but she was often not heard and not taken very seriously, despite the fact that her academic work is perfection. It's just so wonderful. And so I stumbled upon a couple of her books, really just interested in goddess figurines. And perhaps it was a call to my own background, and maybe trying to reach back to see what was going on in the past. And I kind of, from that point on, I followed the trail of the goddess. I then went into my master's. So what was happening for me is I kept asking this question about the Virgin Mary. And I was then, what I realized from Gimbutas' work is that actually a lot of the goddesses were syncretized. And so my question became, okay, if not the Virgin Mary, then who? And who? And who? And moving backwards, right? Who was before her? Right? Yes. And at some point, now I don't remember because it feels like she has always been with me exactly, but at some point I bumped into Artemis. And there was something at the time about the goddess that I could not put my finger on. I guess now I haven't done so much self-reflection. It feels like she really fits my personality in a way. But she spoke to me in a really powerful way, but also in a mysterious way. There wasn't much written about Artemis. She was sort of delegated to Huntress in the woods, maiden. And as I was doing this digging, I realized she's such a complex divinity. And I was finding her everywhere. She was showing up for me literally on TV when I was walking to places. Her name would pop up, or an image of her would pop up, or something. So it was like also what was happening was like you say, almost like a living aspect as well as a cerebral academic aspect. And I asked my mentor, I said, you know, this is a really interesting thing. It seems like Artemis really predates the Virgin Mary and there's a deep connection there. And he's like, that sounds good. Maybe you should do further research on that. It hasn't really been done academically speaking. It has been mentioned, but, you know, something like a deep dive. And so I did that for my master's and it turned out really great. And I became a little more obsessed. And then I applied for my PhD and spent many, many years, eight years, I think, to do the work, the graduate work, the PhD work. And I really disassociated a bit spiritually speaking. I think I was not ready to take a chance. You know, it was, first of all, you're not really allowed in academia, let's be honest. You cannot bring in your spiritual belief in your work. So it's not like it was encouraged. And I didn't know very many goddess worshipers. In fact, I don't know if I knew any in my close, you know, immediate friends. I grew up in what would be sort of like a bad area of Toronto. All my friends were baddies and they were doing other things, you know, so there was no real, like, you know, goddess or spiritual like we were in a city, you know, it's very hard sometimes to find goddess worshipers in the city. Anyway, so yeah, so I did the work and I published my PhD and I went through all the trials and tribulations of that. And it wasn't until I started writing this book that I started asking myself this question of what kind of book do I want to write? Right. I was passing it around to different publishers, academic publishers, and they wanted me to change it in certain ways to fit with their own agendas, which is fair. I wasn't feeling right, you know? And it wasn't until, so this was a few years ago, that I really started going, I think I'm writing this for women who are interested in goddess worship and who are interested in Artemis, perhaps not so academically. And I started to like feel into it a bit more. And while, I mean, as you know, this book does hold a lot of primary source, because I feel like I have to evidence that.
Yeah.
Right. I feel it's like one of the first steps into my argument that Artemis may be one of the most famous goddesses of the ancient world. And so I see this book as a series. So since I wrote this book, I now, she's come to me in from a variety of different countries, like the Balkans, of course, Anatolia, Northern Europe, perhaps even other areas. And so I'm like, oh my God, I think this book is a series. And so the movement has slowly become more, less academic, more personal. And at some point, not that long ago, I started feeling a little, as I met more goddess worshipers and I did more talks and things like that, I started feeling a little bit like, man, I really wish that I had been into goddess worship as a kid. You know, I started thinking like, so I went to goddess festivals where young women were there or little girls were there. And I thought, wow, what a beautiful way to grow up with the goddess, you know? And so I was kind of sitting with myself and going, man, if I only knew the embodiment, the beauty, the connection of the goddess when I was young. And I don't know, one day I was thinking, I was driving, whatever. And I realized, I thought, well, I mean, I was connected to the Virgin Mary for almost my entire life. Perhaps that was the best way that I could connect to the goddess in the way that I was raised, you know, in my family, in my neighborhood, in my religion, and the religion that I was. And once I had that aha moment, I was like, oh, perhaps I have been a goddess worshiper my whole life.
Yes. Oh, I love it. Well, and that feels so in keeping actually with a lot of what I've heard from other guests who grew up in a Catholic environment. I grew up Protestant, so I got nothing, like nothing. There was just no women anywhere, you know? But yeah, so many guests who've talked about feeling that connection to Mary and recognizing her, they're not calling her the divine feminine, but knowing it later. And I feel like that might be even more true for people who are not raised exclusively with an American version of Catholicism, because it seems like in certain other cultures, she is, you know, venerated in like a different way, or, you know, cultures that have held on to like indigeneity a little bit more, that she's can be experienced in that way. So I love that. And I want to know, and you actually answered my next question, which is kind of about how did you find the sacred feminine? But I want to know, this is an interesting thing. And I know you and I have talked about this before, this sort of dance that you have is like, you're an academic, right? You've got your research chops. And I want to know, from the felt sense, was there a point, or is there a way in which that, you know, like you talked about recognizing yourself as a goddess worshiper, like when that really came online, like when you felt like, oh, like more so than I'm studying Artemis, but oh no, this is somebody who's calling me. Have you had that kind of experience?
Yes. So, okay. So throughout this time, let's say from when I started my doctorate work, I would comment, you know, I had to do some traveling for it, and I would comment to everybody on how often she showed up for me. Like I would go into some random place and there she is. And I would go into some other random place and there she is. And I had a few people say to me, you know, that's not very usual. Like you should look into that. You know, that's important. And I thought maybe that's just a sign that I'm on the right track for research. You know, I didn't really take it too deeply. But I did write, I did keep track. So I'm working on this thing, but I'm not yet willing to share it, which is called like In Search of Artemis, which is like all the times that she's shown up for me randomly. But because I think it's so emotional, I'm still a little bit stuck in that, or personal, I think I'm still a little bit stuck in that mindset that like, it's not academic and da-da-da, it's more like a diary, blah, blah, blah. But I'm collecting it because I have a sense that at some point she's going to ask me to share. So there were these moments sort of sprinkled throughout that were a pattern. I could see a pattern. But to be very, very honest with you, I don't know that I've stepped into the label or the label of pagan or goddess worshiper until this past year. This past Christmas, last Christmas I spent it in Crete. It was the first time that I didn't spend Christmas at home. And it was the first time that I told my mother, my very Catholic mother, that I don't celebrate Christmas anymore, that I will not be putting up a tree, even though trees are pagan, but you know, that I will not be celebrating Christmas. And I'm working on it with my mother. We'll see what happens this year. But so I kind of like stepping in, like living the role, right? Like living the truth, which is I'm not Christian anymore. And even actually this Thanksgiving, I had a conversation with my dad about Halloween and how the veil is thin and da 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 da. And my dad is like, oh, like that's old primitive stuff. So the people in my country that predate the Romans are called Dacians or Dacians. And they were conquered anyways. And one of my goals is to research them and see their tribal culture, especially around, because they're really into bears and goddesses and things like that. Yeah. And so I said to my dad, I go, well, the Dacians, which are our ancestors, celebrated, let's say Halloween. They didn't call it Halloween, but whatever. And we had a bit of a debate, which again, sometimes with your parents, you got to take a step back because they get really, my dad's very like non-religious, very like, eh. But I said to him, you know, Dad, like this feels like the right, this connection reaching back 2000 years feels like my connection. It feels authentic to me. Because, you know, we were conquered by Romans. We were conquered by the Ottomans. We were conquered by the Russians. Of course, then we were communists. I don't feel connected to the traditions, if any, that they left us. And so I want to go back. And so it's a bit of like a, it's a bit of like stepping into who you really are, but around you, there's these challenges because I'm not living with goddess worshipers around me. I'm living with either pessimists or Christians sometimes it feels a little bit woo-woo, you know, it feels a little bit like they're like, oh my goodness. And I have a cousin who's also very much into goddess worship. She lives out in New York State, upstate New York. And my mother will go, oh, you're like your cousin. You know, she was been out there woo-woo for a long time. And so there's a bit of a dismissal around that, you know. And so it's a bit challenging, but it feels right. Like I now say it to my students. I will be like, you know, I teach religious studies at York in history. And so I will say in the first day, you don't have to guess my religion. This is my background. And I'm now pagan. And I dance with witches in the moonlight, you know. So
yes.
So I don't know, but I feel like it's time.
Yes,
right? It feels authentic.
Yes. And I want to read something that you wrote in your book, because this, I thought of this as you were talking. Here's what you said. You said, so often in modern depictions of wealth and success, we think of money and careers. That is because humans all over the world have accepted the notion that the new world, in quotation marks, is a progression from a quote old world. The masculine or cerebral perception is that time moves in a straight line and that on the modern side of this line is quote progress. And as such, many of us have lost contact with or simply have never known the raw power of goddess worship, in particular, wild goddess worship. And then you go on to talk about Artemis, which I want to do. But I think that that point that you're making there kind of reminds me of what you were just saying. This idea that it is, it's not just woo-woo, but like primitive.
Yeah.
To hearken back to something like that. And I also really want to call it out in its own way, as it can be racist as well, because the assumption is that this sort of European way of knowing, which is we are going to follow exclusively science and data and logic. And if you have a spiritual tradition, it's got to be from one of these patriarchal religions. Yeah. It's colonial and it's racist to indigenous cultures. So I just, you know, I'm glad that you're naming it here and that you named it in your book as well, because it feels important.
Yeah, it feels like, I think it's because it's the one challenge that is, you know how they talk about generational patterns. And I think it's one of the generational patterns that I'm still working at breaking. So while for myself, I've broken it, speaking it out loud, bringing it up at certain, I mean, for example, this conversation about Halloween just kind of came up because my kids were carving part. Like, so it comes at you from just randomly. And so, being prepared. Also, I think my age has helped, but although I do see that young women, like my daughter has called herself a witch from when she was little. Mm-hmm. And I bought her a witch books and she reads tarot and she knows about astrology and she's taught herself all these things. But I remember even when she was little, my mother would be like, oh, you know, if you keep giving her that, you know, she's going to end up like into this witch's thing. And I thought, right, which is why I'm keep giving her that. Right. So I'm happy that younger women, I hope, are stepping more into their power faster than I think it took me in my household. But also I think it's important that we model a behavior where it's like, if this is your authentic truth, where now I know this is my authentic truth, then I want to share some of the challenges and also what it's like to live in that truth with others.
Right? Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. And I think the more of us that speak about it, then the more normal, quote, normal.
That's right.
What is normal anyways, but the more commonplace it becomes and it doesn't seem so strange. Right. I want to talk about Artemis. I love just the way that there's so much more to her than what I think a lot of people think about, which you address right out of the gate. But I want to share this little story about Artemis. For me, I was, maybe 21. I was in college and I stumbled into this feminist bookstore in North Carolina and thought that I had like died and gone to heaven. And I didn't know. I was just confused. I mean, I think I didn't even know what I was looking at, but I was like, what is this? This is amazing. So I bought Women Who Run With the Wolves, which is of course Pinkola Estes, right? Attempted to read it, wasn't ready, picked it back up when I was 40. And I'm like, now I get it. But anyways,
yes.
And then I also bought this book that was like Archetypes of the Divine Feminine. And I also didn't really understand what an archetype was, but I just thought it was cool. And the one that captured the only one that I remember from the book was Artemis. And they were modern pictures. And so the woman, and this is in the 90s, I'm dating myself, y'all, but this was, you know, so the woman that was representing Artemis was, she was very androgynous. Like she had kind of hair, short hair slicked back. She was standing in like these slouchy jeans and topless and very small. So think like kind of Kate Moss build. And, I was actually dating a woman at the time and I was like, oh, I want to be her and I maybe want to date her too. Mm-hmm. So funny, but that's the one that stood out for me. And, but one of the things that I think is really cool about your book is like, there is that whole idea of, like she's, I don't know if androgyny, I want to hear you talk to that. Like maybe, I don't know if you'd say that that's like common association with her, but because of the virgin, I'm not interested in men thing. Like maybe that's why the androgyny got put on her, but I feel like she sort of gets put in a little box of like, she's out in the woods. She's running around with her bow and arrow. She just don't want to deal with men for sure. She's going to, you know, turn you into a stag and have your dogs rip you to pieces if you see her naked. But there's so much more to her than that. So I want to hear you talk about, you know, Artemis, and I can direct you more, but you know, do you want to just start? Like, it's so big.
Yeah, I just posted something yesterday because I'm doing a couple of lectures on her this tomorrow and Monday, and then at the end of the month, all on her. And I'm so excited. So I posted this whole like TikTok video about like, I'm obsessed, you know, I'm in love. And so you can never ask me, like, I would never not talk about Artemis ever. So and it's honestly like, sometimes I'm shocked at myself. I'm like, haven't I said this 5 times, 10 times? Oh, it's okay. We'll talk about it again. I think it's fantastic that women connect with her. And I'm you know, now that I think of it, I think I should also do a study on like women and how they connected with her, because when I wrote the book, women came out to me. It seemed like they came out of the woodwork and had contacted me and were like, I've connected to Artemis. I've seen Artemis. She's playing. And I didn't know that in my little, like, you know, basement at the university where I like focused on the work, I didn't know that modern, whatever that means, women or people, actually, not even women, all people, because I've had all people contact me, connected with her. And so when that was starting to happen, I was like, oh, there is something still deeply spiritual, psychological, mental here with her. And perhaps that's what it is. Perhaps it's because she doesn't fit a mold. Or maybe we're in a time where her fierceness, like I think she really embodies that word fierce, like something, you know, it's, I know it's a modern word, but, or a trend word, but if we were to call a goddess fierce, I think she really embodies it. And I think she doesn't care for gender roles. Never did. I find that fascinating that even the Greeks couldn't fit her into anything. I mean, they had to give her a twin brother Apollo just to like pretend that there was a male associated with her because they, you know, they were doing that trend. And so she, and you know, when she's young, we have these stories in Homer that she's sitting on Zeus's lap and says, like, I want a city and I want this many nymphs and I want this and I don't want to do it. Da, 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 da. And he's like, okay. So it seems like she really embodied like the desire and the freedom of, let's say, the wildness, right? So, you know, and she was fearless in many ways and unapologetic. And when we think about body-wise, I think androgynous could be a word. I don't know that she's ever sexy. So let's put it that way. So there's no... they weren't able to really sexualize her. I mean, they try a little bit with Orion to say, oh, perhaps her and Orion had a thing. I don't think so. I mean, in my academic opinion, he's more like her bestie. Like, you know, so there's a lot of attempts over time to romanticize her a little bit, or there's some attempts with Diana later on in Rome and depictions of Diana to give her a more feminine looking body. But those seem to be few and far between compared to the other goddesses on the pantheon. So there is something about her that defies categorization, defies gender normalcy, you know? And I would argue that she is also one of the goddesses that has free relationships with, you know, with women. So they're not quite stand outish in the sense that the ancient male philosophers that wrote about her didn't go, oh yeah, well, Artemis was in love with Callisto and they were doing it, you know, all the time. But one of the ways that we can tell that there was intimacy implied there is that when Zeus tries to seduce her, he shapes himself, he transforms into Artemis.
Yes, I read that in your book. I didn't know that. That's so fascinating. Yes.
And so there has been a long tradition saying that Artemis was one of the, you know, like the first sort of lesbian heroes. The Greeks don't use that language, so it's sometimes hard to find it in primary source. But between her and Iphigenia and her and Callisto, there's a lot of this idea that she's not non-sexual. She just chooses to not be sexual with men, if that makes sense. And I know that some people make a big deal about her virginity, but I think for those maybe that don't know, like the idea of Parthenos or virgin, actually I was just reading something today that can, you know, reiterates over and over that a Parthenos or a woman that was considered a virgin could even be a woman that gave birth. So in the Greek times, in the Greek language, Parthenos reflects more a woman that is religious, a woman that is not yet married to a man. It's not about the hymen or her sexual activity. That comes later with Christianity and things like that. And so I think she, in that way, she is the epitome of an independent woman because she may have found herself intimate with whoever she wanted and yet remained virgin, you know, remained independent. I think that's a better word than virgin. You know, we associate so many, there's so many connotations with virgin. And Artemis, I think, is more independent. with who she shares her relationships with.
Well, and your reference to Parthenos, that's like parthenogenesis, right? Which is like creating life without without the external force of the male to create it, right? Like that's the idea. I guess I could see how that would also relate to, well, independence, like maintaining life without that need to be in partnership.
I mean, she's one of the few goddesses that doesn't answer to men, doesn't really speak to men, doesn't like men, and no one challenges her as far as like the ancient playwrights or Homer, if he ever existed, you know? So like Aphrodite and other goddesses, even Athena, although Athena is still supposed to be Parthenos, she answers to men in a sense. Like she is called by Orestes to be a judge, and she's called when they go to war, right? Like she has a responsibility.
Yeah. And she speaks for them too.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Like she represents the viewpoint of the patriarchy really well at times, right? Athena?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Artemis is the only one, I'm arguing. I mean, there may be, I mean, people sometimes talk about Demeter, but Demeter has the responsibility of motherhood. She's kind of chained to Persephone in that way. To me, Artemis is the only one in that pantheon that is truly independent. And truly unapologetic about, and truly, what is her responsibility? Her responsibility is enjoying herself.
Oh, gosh, can't you see how, I mean, no wonder, like, she's a
like, goddess. She is the epitome of self-care. Like, I want to go into the woods today. I want to go hunting today. I want to go and do this today. You know, she does as she pleases whenever she wants, and she answers to no one, which I think, I mean, perhaps the Greeks didn't mean it this way, but it's still quite revolutionary, even for that time. And of course, for our time, it's
yeah. Wonderful. Oh yeah. That's what I was going to say. I mean, what a goddess for our time in particular. yes. I'm looking at your book because I'm like, like I said, I highlighted all these things that I loved. Okay. Here, I'm going to read this part that you wrote, which is kind of reiterating what you just said. But anyways, while Athena is a virgin goddess of war and wisdom, she's often to be found in patriarchal spaces governed by law and rules and male-centered civic duty. Aphrodite's not a virgin, but she is trapped under the category of love goddess, constantly chasing vanity, sexuality, and male consorts. Hera is forcibly married to a charlatan. Yeah, just love you calling Zeus on the table like that. So good. While Demeter is shoved so deeply into a maternal role that she cannot think of anything else but her daughter Persephone for 6 months of the year. It is only Artemis, whether by coincidence or design, who remains free to wander through the forest, spend her time among nymphs and she-bears, and take her vengeance whenever and however she desires. So good.
Thank you. I'm pretty, when I listen to you read it, I'm like, oh, that was good, Carla. That was pretty good.
Funny. I've had the same reaction sometimes when people read something from my book. I'm like, did I write that? Yes. Well, I want you to talk about the vengeance piece too, because I am having a love moment right now with really complicated, complex goddesses. I think they have so much to teach us for this moment. And one of the things that really irks me, and I don't know how you feel about this, but I get frustrated when I will hear people, women, make blanket statements. Once upon a time, several thousand years ago, there was the Great Mother, and everybody believed in the Great Mother, and everybody, you know, and the Great Mother was this like kind and loving. And I'm like, no, I don't feel like, you know, the historical record way better than I do, but that doesn't seem to be accurate. And not only does it not seem accurate, but it feels like, in a way, it's still shoehorning women into a box. And the reality of these ancient goddesses is, I'm thinking of Inanna here too, like they are freaking complex. Like you cannot just paint them with the brush of the loving mother that you want to snuggle up to. Yes, they may be that, and they hold a lot of this other energy too. So I wonder if you could talk to that a little bit in regards to Artemis.
Yeah, actually, it's funny that you say that, because I've been thinking about that the last few talks that I did one at a festival just last month. And my call to that talk was to talk about vengeance and to talk about angry goddesses. And these talks that I'm doing coming up are about ritual and sacrifice. And one of my things is like how bloodthirsty Artemis is. And I also feel, okay, so I feel like, and this is my own perspective, I feel like because we are moving into this her story, her world, her history, there are two things that are happening. Number one, there's a lot of people that are letting go of monotheism, that I sometimes see them almost reframe the goddess into their monotheistic comfort structure. There's nothing wrong with that, as long as maybe you're a little more aware of it. So that's the first thing that I sometimes notice, is that instead of talking about he, everybody talks about she, but she is ever loving, ever creative, ever, and she is mother instead of father. So it's very parental. One of the things that was very difficult for me to overcome through meditations and things like that was this idea that Artemis kept showing up to me as friend, as collaborator. So I would keep saying mother, and I could feel her going like, don't call me mother, you know, like this kind of thing. Like, well, I think that there may be a creatrix, you know, instead of a creator. I'm starting to feel like goddesses are preferred to be collaborative. There's some that are a little more authoritative. For example, you could call Demeter mother quite easily, although I'd be gentle with that because I don't know that she wants to be everyone's mother. But I started to feel like many of the goddesses are more collaborators. Now, how do you teach and work with women who come out of a paternal religious structure that the divine is equal to you and a collaborator with you? And I'm speaking out of experience, because when I first moved away from my own paternal religion, everything I did was on my knees, praying on my knees, thank you, gratefulness. And gratefulness is like, all these things are good, but it's very submissive behavior.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I started to feel like a real pushback, even in my dreams. I started to have a real pushback. I would have dreams where I'm walking in front of the goddess and I'm kneeling, and she goes like, stand. This is not a kneeling thing. And so I think that is something that we need to work on. I think now we're in the phase where people are coming to the goddess, but they don't know. Everyone has been trained to be meek in a way, to be stay humble, blah, 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 blah. I feel like Artemis is the one goddess that is like, no, don't be humble. What's humble? I don't respect, you know, her nymphs are not humble, right? Her entourage of women are powerful women, and she does not tell them, bow to me. You know, she does not tell them, you know, she does ask for a commitment. That is fair, especially in a world where there's competing pantheon of gods. But it's not a submissive. It's not get on your knees. It's not obey. It's not, you know. So I think that that's part of it. The other part is that I think there's a lot of women that come to goddess worship that are wounded. And they need the love and warmth.
Yes.
Of mothering.
Yes. And I want to say too, just, I don't mean to interrupt you, but I wanted to add, and to be clear, because I think you write about this in the book, Artemis does hold that energy. It's not that mothering, nurturing part is not part of the sacred feminine, and even part of some of these complex goddesses, right? It's just not all of her, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes. And so I think that, for example, when women are in labor and they come to her, or women are injured, or women are violated and they come to her, there is a nurturing aspect. There's also a vengeful aspect. And I think that empowers us in the sense, like she does with Actaeon, if you cross me, you will pay. And I'm not going to be apologetic about that or humble about it. And so that has been, I think maybe that's why I'm emphasizing so much of her bloodthirstiness and her rituals and sacrifice, because I do want to talk exactly about that. The fact that ancient goddesses embody the complexities of what it means to be a woman. And as women, we are the most complex gender, like, not sorry, you know, we are smarter, wiser, stronger, faster, quicker, more cunning. There are so many aspects of womanhood. I just saw a study yesterday that talked about the size of brains between men and women, and how women have like 50,000 more thoughts a day than men, like this kind of thing, you know? And I thought, yeah, that makes sense. I'm not surprised that ancient goddesses embody that, because I think both all genders in the past would have recognized that a goddess is vicious and perhaps can get her way in a variety of ways. You know, Inanna gets her way in many ways. Artemis gets her way in many ways, blah, blah. So I do think that they embody a full experience of what it means to be, to live in a female body, you know, or identify, you know, in a female, as a female in the world, where you may have to be sometimes cunning, sometimes a little vicious, where you are taking on a lot of responsibility, where you do sometimes have to give punishment, take back what you may be owed, or you certainly feel frustrated at the injustice of what you may be owed, where you're dealing with violations. Like, I think there's a lot of that that is embodied in goddess worship. And I'm not sure that everyone is ready for it, but maybe, like, so when I did this one seminar at the last Goddess Festival, there were so many women there that really enjoyed that aspect. So I was really happy, because I was a little worried, because the whole weekend was about love and warmth and sharing, which I love too, because sometimes I need, because I am a little, I'm a Capricorn, I'm a little bit of a all the time. And so love and kindness is really welcome. But I was like, oh, my talk is going to be a little bit vicious. And yet the response was, like, that was really great. I really enjoyed that aspect. So I don't know, Liz, maybe a combination.
Well, you know what? Two things are coming up as you're saying that. And one is this idea of multiplicity, which is something that I try to hit a lot and have been talking about in this class that I've been teaching, of like, she invites us into multiplicity, like holding, like, she is, I think the sacred feminine is a dissolver of binaries. Like, you can't, like, you know what I mean? Like, you can't,
love that. Yes.
You can't hold it, like, right? Because anything that you are like, we're like, oh, she is definitely this. You can turn around on the other side and be like, and she's also this. So what are you going to do with that? Are you either going to disavow one or the other? Or are you going to stretch yourself and your container and your brain and your body to hold them both, and then recognize that you hold those energies within you too? And that is one of the many reasons why I think the sacred feminine is so valuable to us right now, and can really be like a door opener away from monotheism and patriarchal thinking.
Yes.
And then the other thing, let me see if I can get this out of my head into words, but the other thing that was really kind of paradoxical to me about what you're saying, you know, you're talking about the, you know, women being the most complex gender and all that, but what you're also saying is, like, all of these qualities that women have not been allowed to have, right? We have been kind of pushed into that nurturing box. Like, I even say this about the sacred feminine, is that all of the qualities and attributes that we've ascribed to being feminine, whether or not those are accurate, we've labeled them as lesser. And so if we reclaim those, but then we also say, and as Artemis demonstrates, women are cunning and vicious and bloodthirsty and all these things, paradoxically, you just start to break down the gender rules anyways, right? Because all of a sudden now you're finding all these things, like, you're like, oh wait, they, like, the, these sort of gender boxes we put each other, they don't work regardless.
You know, it's so funny that you say that, because language has, I'm starting to feel like language has become such a barrier even for myself, because I often have conversations with friends where I'm like, well, I don't like labeling this masculine or feminine, because obviously all genders experience all aspects of these categories.
Yes.
But when I'm talking, you fall into the way to describe certain attributes. You're absolutely right. And even when I talk about Artemis, I say, well, she embodies the masculine and the feminine, which is true, but also language is limited, you know, in that way. So I don't really know what the answer to that is, but perhaps, like, being aware that we are all of these, and that may, perhaps that's the problem with toxic masculinity. Well, it is that they don't allow, you know, for femininity to be a part of the full embodiment of, you know, and so it's a bit of a language barrier when you're talking, because you're using these terms.
Yes.
It's also a modern, you know, it's a Greek sort of duality invention. We don't know that pre-Greek people or pre-Sumerian people even thought or used that kind of language.
Yeah.
Right. And so imagine a world where, like, when we talk about Inanna, for example, how she switches genders and she, and she switches pronouns, and, like, imagine a world in which that is fluid, truly fluid. Like, it's not a hiccup. You know, who knows what we might have lived like
right
in a time, right, that we were not encased in these labels.
Yes. And then I think of, you know, just going back to your research with Artemis and some of these really complex goddesses and things too, is almost feel like they are wayfinders for us to help us get out of these boxes, like, right? And we are actively navigating it. So like, there's not an answer, like, we don't know. We cannot just, we are a product of our ancestors and like all of the cultural conditioning that brought us to here. So we don't really know what it felt like to live back then, but it's almost like they are sort of kind of pointing us in the right direction. And as I'm saying that, I wish like you who are listening could see, you got to go on the Zoom and see Carla's backdrop, because it's like Artemis is literally shooting an arrow into Carla's brain right now, like from her book. And it just feels so.
It feels like that, isn't it?
It feels so appropriate to me to this conversation.
That was not on purpose at all.
Like just injecting, you know, your brain with like this, like, I don't know, with this thinking and this way of navigating the world in a different way. Like, does that make sense to you? Like, I do feel like that's sort of our time and our era, is we don't know the freaking answers, but we are kind of trying to get back on the path or find our way. And that these powerful and complicated goddesses are our, to your point, they are collaborators. They're walking with us, or they're saying, come on, follow me. I can show you.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And this is why, as we were talking before we started recording, I would really like to put together this project where I'm documenting some of these artifacts, because I think one of the things that has come up for me anyways, as an academic, is a lack of accessibility for women to see the plethora of artifacts, of primary stores, of temple sites. I feel almost like many times I come across this kind of idea. Oh yeah, well, a long time ago, they might've had some figurines. And sometimes I go, you know, there were like thousands, maybe millions, like, you know, or they go, oh yeah, you know, Artemis has a few. And I'm like, you know, that many of her temples are still undocumented. She probably had hundreds, maybe thousands that are still out there. And so I think there's a little piece of me that says, there's the more we visually see these pieces, the more easier it is for many other women, let's say, who are maybe on the fence, to really believe that this is a real, I say that in quotation marks, but it's a historical fact. It's a historical, it belongs to us.
Yeah.
It's what comes natural. Again, I say that in quotations, to us, and to everyone, like, you know, even of course, everyone in that society was worshiping these divinities. And many of these men that sculpted these divinities took pride in worshiping goddesses. Like, it's such a different way of thinking that sometimes it's hard for me to explain, that it's not necessarily even anti-male. It is anti-patriarchy, but it's a different world. And we just, you know, we got to just keep collecting the data and sharing the data in order. And I feel like that's my service, and probably, you know, you feel the same way, in the sense that you're called to share what you've come across and what you've experienced, in hopes that other people can join and open themselves up and heal themselves and I don't know, reconnect in a way that's powerful, because I think it's pretty clear that monotheism is not serving anybody anymore. Like, there's a lot of movement, as my students, you know, I have hundreds of students every year, and I teach religious studies, and you know, so many of them are atheists.
Yes.
You know, so many of them are untethered. And I feel like, well, perhaps if we go back a little bit, maybe you can find a more authentic or genuine connection. Like, so I'm trying to say to them, the divine exists. Yes. The other world is real. The connection to the energies, the spiritual realm, that is a real thing. You may not believe in that anymore because you've been somehow disappointed or disconnected from. And so I ask myself, how do I bridge that a little bit? Not to tell you who to believe or anything like that, but to create this connection, to see that it is like, when I talk about astrology and people go, oh, astrology. And I'm like, the ancients 10,000 years ago were using astrology in a way we still can't figure it out. Our math comes from there. Language comes from there. Seasons comes from there. Everything comes from there. Let's not dismiss it. Like, again, oh, it's just astrology and tarot readers. And I'm like, so I feel sometimes that, like, you know, maybe that's why I got the PhD, is like to shove it in some doors, you know, stick my foot a bit in the door and go, no, you have to take me seriously about, I don't know, astrology, let's say, because it was from that time. And here I've done the research and here, you know, and shove it in there. Yeah, you know, so it's a bit of a almost like prove yourself,
mm-hmm.
you know, prove this is true. And you're like, okay.
But you can. Oh, that's the thing. Yeah. And that's one of the reasons
I'm working on that. Yeah.
Yeah. That's one of the reasons I, you know, I get all fired up about, like I said in the intro, of like having these conversations you know, not being an academic. I've always been kind of like a wannabe academic. I'm just a geek but maybe didn't want to like invest fully in going that route. But I have also wanted, because my brain is satisfied with history and facts and things like that, like I've wanted those, and I feel like I hit that really hard in my own book. And also have probably said it on the show a lot, like this, it's out there. If you are this kind of person, like if you are fed by the history and the logical information, it's there.
Yeah.
It's all there. And the fact that you haven't found it has nothing to do with its significance and its importance, and everything to do with who's been telling the stories and who's been prioritizing which information and what lens they've been looking at it through. And so, yeah. And I have to imagine, like, you know, yes, you went all in on the academic route, but I really do think that there are probably a lot of women who would be hungry for knowing this. If nothing else, it's just your birthright. Like, even if you like want to bring it up at a cocktail party and let it go, fine, but at least you got it.
I bring it up all the time at a cocktail party. You know, and some of my favorite, I mean, two of my favorite non-academic scholars, Laura Perry and Max Dashu.
Yes.
I mean, you know, you don't have to be an academic to, although it may be a little more challenging because you do get these people that come out of the woodwork going, oh, you don't have an egg, but their work is flawless.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Flawless. And so you're right. You're right. It is out there. And I think, if you're wondering and if you're curious, you can find it. And perhaps this is where we create communities where, okay, you found it. You might have more questions. Come join us in the community, and there'll be a mix of experts, spiritual experts, academic experts, other kind of experts there, where perhaps, you know, people can get some more answers. Because it's not just a cerebral thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like, I feel like my service is a bit cerebral at this point. You know, there have been people that have said, so what do you think about your future? Like, do you think you're going to be like a priestess or a leader or whatever? And I'm like, I don't know right now. I got to write 8 books on Artemis. She's pointing it. You know, she's like, look at me over here. You see me here in the Carpathians. Look at me over here. Write a book about this. So I have to do the service first. But there are lots of women that are called to those positions that I also look to when I need a break from my brain.
Yeah.
Right. You know, and such an amazing service that is. Oh my God.
Yeah.
That's so much. Yeah.
Well, and Max has been on the show. I'll put that in the show notes. She was an early guest in, I think, back 2020 when I started the show. So I'll put, oh, bless her. I was like just starting and I'm like, will you please come on my show? And she did. Like, she's amazing. So you're right. I'll put that in the show notes. And the other thing that I wanted to mention too, and like, maybe this is a good kind of place to wrap up, is this feels like another conversation around the multiplicity of the divine feminine. Like, yes, she plays in this academic space and she plays in the spiritual space, and like, she can hold space for all of it. And I think by exploring her, we get to see that we can do that too. Like, we don't have to be this one thing or this other thing. We get to be all those things.
Yes. I think you're absolutely right. I think that's a great closing point. I think that has been my in the moment right now challenge, is to shed a little bit of the cerebral, not shed it, but be able to spiritually connect. And I think that the goddess is the example of that. There are moments when I travel, when I stand in a cave as a writer, and I write the experience. And then there's a few moments where I perform a ritual or a prayer or a song or something. And the experience is so totally bodied, that I then have to sit back and go, like, you know, wow. Okay. I don't know what to do with that other than there's no doubt in my mind that that was a connection, you know? And I think lately she's been coming for me in that way. Lately, because I have this thing, you know, maybe, I don't know, maybe, but I have this thing every now and then where I'm like, am I really experiencing that? Was that really, you know, I have that thing in the back of my mind that is sometimes skeptical and challenging. And then she'll like whack me with something else. And I'll be like, okay.
Yes. Well, and this sounds like, I can't wait to read your book that you, where you're writing down all the ways she showed up to you. Cause it sounds like, you know, with her arrow towards your brain right now and the screen there, that she's like, no, you don't get to question this. Like, I'm very there.
That's right.
Oh, I love it. Carla, this went so fast. I don't even know how this was so fun. I feel like I could talk to you all day, but you just have to come back when you do this research project or your next book or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, we'll get into it again. That would be super fun.
I will. Yes. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. And for reading the book and for helping me promote this book and this message. And thank you so much.
Yes.
Yeah, so let's, all of you listening.
Yes. And so tell them, Carla, how they can find you. If they want to find your book or they want to find you on social, I'll put this all in the show notes, but.
So social is Artemis Expert across the board, everywhere. And I think pretty much every social media platform. The Goddess Project podcast is where I talk about goddesses, and do some research on the goddesses, and the Artemis Research Center, which is a place where I'm working on collecting data on Artemis and some other stuff. So that's a website. They can just, the Artemis Research Center, and join me there as well. Sign up for the newsletter. Yeah.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. And thanks to everybody for listening. As always, it's a joy to have you on the other side. I feel like I've met more of you now that are listening and it feels really good. You know, like I know you're a podcaster too, Carla. So I'm always like, is anybody out there? And it always makes me happy when somebody reflects back to me. Like, yes, you're listening. Like I can see the stats, but so anyways, I'm glad you're there. I'm glad you're into this topic, that you share a passion for it. And, as always, if you like the show, you can leave it a favorable review. You can tell your friends about it. You can subscribe to it. You can do all those things. And until next time, take very good care of yourself. Celebrate your multiplicities. And yes, I'll be back with you again soon. Home to Her is hosted by me, Liz Kelly. You can visit me online at hometoher.com, where you can find show notes and other episodes. You can read articles about the sacred feminine, and you'll also find a link to join the Home to Her Facebook group for lots more discussion and exploration of her. You can also follow me on Instagram at hometoher to keep up to date with the latest episodes. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you back here soon.